What are the balls in Balls to the Wall?
Why were Mad Hatters mad?
Can you really pull yourself up by your bootstraps?
We heard through the grapevine that you wanted another episode about idiom origin, so let's cut to the chase on another Words Unravel.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell.
And I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words. And this time round, we're pulling out all the stops to bring you an episode about idioms.
Yes, this was a very popular theme last time. We took some requests. We did a few idioms during one of our more recent seasons or series, and a lot of people really enjoyed it. We did also get a lot of theories in the comments, which were kind of entertaining. I would say, like, as we proceed through these, I'll note that, like, yes, there are many theories for all of these idioms, and the one you heard might be correct. The way we're assessing correctness, or at least the way I'm assessing correctness, is through sources like the OED, which confirms original recorded variations, and then actual like written record that you can find so far back.
You see, Jess is being tactful as ever here, but what she's really saying is, yeah, if we say it's a thing and then in the comments you write, but actually I think you're fine, it's this. And you might be right, but, you know, we have done the research. We're not just making all of this up.
Yeah, I would say, I think the most dramatic one last time was break a leg. And we went through the OED's assessment of the most reliable theories. And there were a lot of less reliable theories in the comments.
A lot of people are really desperate for break the leg to mean find yourself in a cast.
Yes. Right? But That's a pun.
It's extremely satisfying, the association between the word cast and breaking a leg.
Yes.
And very tempting. But we did come across it before. We said that we thought it was something else. And Anyway, we do actually want to hear your alternatives.
Yeah, no, I love the faux theories, and we'll also address the theories that are less likely as far as we have found them.
We get a kick out of hearing alternatives to these,
because often the stories are great.
Yeah, the stories really, really are great, and we might be wrong occasionally as well. You never know. So where do we start? Well, I've got one that I think would be good to break the ice.
Uh huh.
And that's break the ice.
Excellent. The polar bear of idioms.
When you hear the phrase break the ice, what sort of image is going on in your head?
Honestly, the first thing I think of is the joke. You walk up to somebody and you just say polar bear, and they're like, what? And you say, it broke the ice. And that is the immediate thing I think of.
That is quite the chat-up line. I'm going to try that one. Well, so to me, when I hear someone talking about breaking the ice, usually in a social conversation where things are a little bit cold, maybe there's a bit of a sort of icy atmosphere, and someone is just sort of cracking through that sort of icy crust to get to the sort of softer, looser, wetter stuff below. No, I mean, it's just for people to be more comfortable in that social situation. And that, you know, is what it has meant for a few hundred years. But originally, the term break the ice, it's not about specifically creating a pleasant atmosphere for exchange. It's more about creating a path for others to follow. And that speaks to precisely where the term comes from, which is the breaking of ice in, for example, a fjord or whatever, or as is done by icebreaker ships these days, to enable the passage of other people through an area. Here's an example from 1590. It goes back as far as that, which is amazing, because again, it feels when you talk about icebreakers when you go on a work away day or something like that, but you are referencing something from the 16th century. This quote says, "The author, therefore, in adventuring to break the ice to make the passage easy for his countrymen, failing sometimes at the ford and falling into the pit, may seem worthy to be pitied." But you can hear that idea of breaking the ice to enable safer passage for the other people. And then there's another one from 1602 along the same lines. "It is my duty to begin, I know, and I will break the ice of courtesy. You are welcome home, sir."
That's lovely.
Yeah. And then later on, not much later though, you know, within a sort of 150 years, it becomes more associated with social situations and
corporate culture.
Yeah, very fledgling corporate culture at that. But here's the weird thing. So it is about the physical breaking of ice, you know, in icy conditions. But in English, the term is recorded figuratively before it is recorded literally, as in the fording of ice is referred to as breaking the ice later than the figurative idea of breaking the ice for some other reason, you know, actual literal ice. And that's probably because it was a Latin idiom beforehand. So we get the Latin idiom that we translate. The Latin idiom is scindere glaciem, which means, to break the ice. Like you say, there's a sort of corporate feel to that phrase, breaking the ice.
Yeah, right.
Nowadays. Now, just before we started recording, Jess and I did just ask one another what sort of things we'd like to cover. And you mentioned a fair few that I actually sort of think of as kind of corporate.
Ooh, what's that?
I think you can probably guess, but it's not because they are corporate in themselves, like breaking the ice, but it's because they have this sort of American sound to them. And so many idioms that we get from American speech come to us through corporate culture.
I'm guessing you're thinking along the lines of like push the envelope.
Yes, I am.
That's a pretty cool one. This one and balls to the wall are from aviation, and somebody's going to be like, but wait, what about? And don't worry, I'll get to it in a second.
Balls to the wall is to do with aviation.
Hang on a sec. So first, push the envelope. It means obviously to test the limits, to go further, faster, riskier than before, which of course appeals to corporate culture and the growth paradigm that we live in. So the envelope in question comes from aeronautics. In flight testing, the flight envelope refers to the boundary of an aircraft's operational capabilities, which is usually graphed out in terms of altitude, speed, and atmospheric conditions. And I couldn't confirm whether this is true, but if you look at an envelope chart, it kind of looks a little like an envelope. So I don't know if that was intentional or if it's just meant to consider what is enveloped in that range. So to push the envelope is to fly just outside of that zone.
You know, if I can just interrupt briefly.
Oh, yeah.
When you mentioned it was going to be about aeronautics and envelopes, I immediately started thinking about hot air balloons, because isn't that actually the name for the bit that fills up with air? That's called the envelope.
I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
I believe you.
It is. It's called the envelope. So I thought, maybe if we're pushing the envelope, we're filling it with as much air as possible.
I would rather take risks in a test flight in a plane than in a hot air balloon. For some reason, that sounds a lot scarier.
Really?
Less walls around you.
I can picture you in a montgolfier, though, on a trip around the world.
But anyway, this entered corporate culture. We've mentioned this before, I think, in our last idiom episode, as a matter of fact, but Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, helped introduce a lot of aviation terms into general parlance. And he mentions in The Right Stuff, one of the phrases that kept running through the conversation of like test pilots and like the machismo culture that came with it, was pushing the outside of the envelope, which would increase the satisfaction and challenge of a test flight.
Right.
So balls to the wall is also from aviation. It's older, though. It's from around World War II. Many military planes were designed with ball-shaped grips on engine controls, particularly the throttle, but other controls. So to get to maximum power, you would push it all the way forward toward the front of the cockpit, which was the firewall to prevent the engine from catching you on fire. To go into a dive, similarly, you would also push... I don't know enough about the insides of planes, but I have seen documentation. But if you wanted to go into a dive, same thing. You would push the balls or the lever tops to the firewall. And so it's the equivalent of pedal to the metal.
Right. It's putting your foot down, but really it's putting your hand on the balls.
But a lot of people
pushing them to the wall
who are watching this are going to be like, but it's actually about trains.
Oh.
It kind of is, but kind of isn't. And there are two older phrases, balling the jack and balls out, that also mean the same thing. I thought I was supposed to be the immature one here.
We're going balls out this time.
Goodness. And this refers to these round metal weights that are on steam train engines, centrifugal governors, which regulates the speed of a steam engine by controlling the flow of steam to the cylinders. It spins, and these balls extend outward as it approaches maximum speed.
I see.
So it was balls out, but not balls to the wall. I saw your fan.
Yeah, I still keep that fan. Ever since the swearing episode, I've kept my fan very handy.
And there are a number of other theories, but those are the more likely ones.
I have found some sort of slightly rude idioms while I've been looking around. I'm not going to drag us down the toilet, but I came across this 16th century book of idioms. What it actually is, it is a poem consisting almost entirely of idioms, and it is pretty much unreadable. The title of this book is A Dialogue Containing the Number in Effect of All the Proverbs in the English Tongue Compact in a Matter Concerning Two Manner of Marriages, Made and Set Forth by John Heywood. By John Heywood.
Very compact indeed.
yeah, exactly. But more, so that is from 1546, but a more recent, a much more recent, thankfully, version of it from 1906 includes a list of all of the idioms involved and explanations of them. And among the idioms that one can find in this work from the 16th century, these are idioms that we don't have anymore, but clearly were in use back then. You have, ye taunt me tit over thumb. It's a bit like, well, what we say, you know, it's totally. So it's a bit like, you know, head over heels, or as we might say, arse over tit these days. Folly it is to spurn against a prick.
Wait, hang on. What? Is that like, don't make fun of my business?
No, what it means is, what would be a good alternative to it? Now, it's a bit like, don't let sleeping dogs lie. To spurn against something is to sort of force yourself up against it or to come up against something. And so folly it is to spurn against a prick is to sort of, you know, don't push yourself against something pointy because it's going to go inside you.
Okay. So we're more literal on that one.
Yeah, exactly. There's an alternative you could have used as well, which is ye shoot nigh the prick, which is actually to get a bullseye because the prick is the end of it.
I mean, people have been punning on the use of the word prick since we have a record of it in Shakespeare, as I think we may have mentioned in our last episode.
But I actually came to this book because I was researching idioms relating to butter.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it'll all become clear. I'll tell you my starting point, and it was to butter someone up. I was thinking, right, where does that phrase come from? But there is a 15th century, 16th century idiom, which is, it is not all butter that the cow s***s.
True.
No explanation is given for what this means figuratively. I mean, it's factual, but it comes in a sort of verse that is, but against gay glosses this rude text recites, it is not all butter that the cow
nice little rhymey business there.
Poetry. But yeah, I was looking up
Dr. Seuss of a bygone era.
yeah, of his day, Mr. Heywood. Yeah, but to butter someone up, where does that come from? Do you have an idea in your head of where that comes from?
Butter is an expensive and delicious thing that not everyone can afford. So you're, you know, flattering them or giving them a gift or bribing them or something. Same as like having your bread buttered on both sides.
Yeah. And I think that makes more sense than the explanation that is most broadly given, which is a really entertaining one. But for me, it just smells wrong. And that is that the term actually comes from an ancient Hindu practice of hurling ghee butter at statues of gods in order that the gods would in some way favor you as a result of it. So you'd be covering them in butter. You would be buttering the gods up. And that is the explanation you'll see everywhere. But I think an explanation more along your lines, or I think more like the idea of lavishing someone with praise is like sort of slathering them with butter, which in itself is quite an opulent product. I prefer that explanation.
The same logic does seem to kind of apply to buttering statues of gods. I mean, you're currying favor by buttering.
It's true, but I just can't think of many other idioms where we invoke the practices of ancient Hinduism in the English-speaking world. That's why I find that one a little bit strange.
There's a lot more evidence for, I don't know, not evidence. It makes more sense logically and chronologically for that to simply be a good use of butter.
Yeah. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, as Freud said. But other ones that are in this mad book of old idioms that are butter related, because butter appears to have been quite a big deal in the past, because like you say, it was a value. I know on which side my bread is buttered. is in there, which is one that we still use.
And I mentioned having your bread buttered on both sides. That means like basically benefiting from two conflicting parties and benefiting from both of them.
Right. So those two concepts go together perfectly, don't they? Because to know which side your bread is buttered is to know where your advantage comes from. To have it buttered on both sides is to have your advantage coming from everywhere. Check your privilege. You've got things far too good. There'll be no butter cleave on my bread is an old phrase, which means nothing by which to profit or advantage. It means basically you haven't got anything. So it's the inverse of the having your bread buttered on both sides is having it not buttered on either. And there's another one that also appears in a verse, which is every promise that thou therein dost utter is as sure as it were sealed with butter. So as sure as sealed with butter is an old idiom or proverb, meaning that it's not secure at all.
Right, because you can't seal things with butter. It's
No, you can't. And if you were to seal, for example, a letter or whatever with butter, it would pretty soon unstick.
Excellent. I have a couple of at least like tangentially food related idioms here. Like I heard it through the grapevine, which has nothing to do with food, but ultimately, but Marvin Gaye has our favorite song about it. But the original grapevine was a real telegraph line. As a matter of fact, in 1859, Colonel Frederick B. and the Placerville and Humboldt Telegraph Company constructed a wire line from Placerville, California to Virginia City, Nevada. And it was rugged and remote. And so, and they didn't use poles. So they were just like flinging them over trees and letting them like curl and sag. The idea was that they were like California grapevines. And the line broke all the time because it was strung over trees. And sometimes it was snowed on or a tree fell on it. And so it became known as the grapevine telegraph. So it became a symbol, so to speak, of unreliable or rumor-based communication because it was unreliable. Then during the Civil War, the phrase was also adopted into like military and enslaved communities when Union soldiers would use it to refer to informal camp gossip and the fragmented flow of information during the war, since everything kind of tore apart. And meanwhile, enslaved people in the American South were using the term grapevine telegraph to refer to a covert information network built through like mobility and oral exchange between plantations. And you could carry like rumors, messages of resistance or misinformation or like notions of rebellion through the grapevine telegraph.
Yeah, the latter was the version of the story, not the version of the story, just the context in which I the earliest context in which I'd heard of this grapevine telegraph, but it goes back even further.
It was originally an actual telegraph line that was very unreliable.
Not a very good one.
Similar in sense, in terms of reliability, would be something that has gone haywire. Are you familiar with that term?
I am, but I haven't got a clue what it means.
It means something that's come undone. It's chaotic. It's unpredictable. It's malfunctioning beyond reason. If your laptop goes haywire, it's not working. Or if you are going haywire, you might be having a full-blown psychological meltdown. Originally, it was just like cheap wire used to bind bales of hay. And it was soft and it was springy. It wasn't really meant for precision work, but people would use it to fix things on the fly. So a haywire outfit would be something that was poorly equipped, slapped together. I think it was originally used in like logging operations. A haywire outfit was one that was supposedly like pulled together with this metaphorical twine or an improvised repair.
So you need this idea of the haywire outfit to get from the current meaning to literally what haywire is, right? If something goes haywire, it means it has gone as if it is a haywire outfit.
And it's like unraveling in all directions. It might break apart. It looks all messy.
I think whenever I've heard that term, I have been thinking of electrical wire rather than something...
Literal haywire?
Yeah, or more primitive. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know what I thought the hay was. Can I go sort of loosely linked down a rabbit hole? I'm being very literal here. Of madness, because I want to talk about the phrase mad as a hatter.
Yes, that's a good one.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those ones that, you know, if you look into idioms, you will have come across. It's got a very good, sort of seemingly quite solid origin story. The term, by the way, predates Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, the idea of, you know, being mad as a hatter. That is why Lewis Carroll has the Mad Hatter in his books. And the idea is that hatters were a bit mad because they all have mercury poisoning because of the mercurous nitrate that was used in the making of felt hats. You know, it would give off these fumes and it would send hatters mad. So that's why the hatter was mad. But do you know why the March Hare was mad?
No, tell me.
Because in March...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hares are kind of horny. Yep. And a male hare might be, yeah, a little bit hopping mad.
Ah, very nice.
Another leap then. Hopping mad. Mad as a box of frogs. Have you ever heard that?
I have, but it doesn't come up that often.
No, and there's no real obvious explanation for it either. It's more common in Britain, I know that much, and it actually was kind of a fashionable phrase. You know how sometimes phrases just become a bit fashionable? It's like, you know, gaslighting has become a sort of fashionable thing to talk about these days, or maybe it did sort of 3 or 4 years ago and I'm a bit behind. But
from the film Gaslight, right?
Yeah, but which is not a contemporary reference, right? And the idea of being mad at a box of frogs, for some reason in Britain in the noughties, became something that people like to start talking about, even though there was a band in the 80s called Box of Frogs, which was clearly invoking the idea of a mad box of frogs. This band was formed by former members of the Yardbirds, which was a British band. I don't know if you've heard of them, but, you know, the band that spawned Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, basically all of the best British guitarists. But we don't know where it comes from. But I mean, to me, it seems like, well, if we have the phrase hopping mad, then a box of frogs must have an awful lot of hopping.
Yeah, I expect that's it. I mean, I think that phrase kind of gets riffed on a good bit. Like I've seen like mad as a bag of cats and stuff like that. So yeah. Anything that flails.
I did look this up. I looked up other madasses from down the years. In the 14th century, you can find mad as a goose. Geese find their way. They find their way into old idioms. We have mad as May butter from the 17th century. I don't know why butter is particularly mad in May. Not because it's horny, I don't suppose, like the March Hare.
Maybe you get a lot of butter from your cows in May because they're like well fed and it's spring. I don't know. I'm totally speculating here.
Well, yeah. So in spring, I guess they're producing more milk for their young. So.
Because they might, yeah, produce more calves.
But what's mad about it? That's what I don't know. Although don't cows go a little bit mad if you don't milk them?
Oh, they might. And also if you attempt to mess with their babies. So maybe if you are milking a cow while it has a baby, then it might mess you up a little bit.
Yeah, it's a funny little fact that the most deadly animal in Britain is the cow.
Right? I believe it.
It causes more deaths each year than any other animal, which is mad. And it's usually dog walkers whose dogs disturb the calves during the spring.
I feel like that's like frequency bias though, right? Like it's the largest animal that can kill you.
They're dangerous. Of course, the most dangerous animal in Britain is man. Australia and New Zealand have their own versions of as mad as a meat axe is recorded only in Australian and New Zealand usage.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, it's not very nice, is it? And then you've got as mad as a cut snake, which is also not very nice, but it does feel like only Australia could produce that phrase. And then here's an interesting local one. This one is only attested in my part of Britain, very specifically from Derbyshire, and it is as mad as a tup.
Is that like a sheep?
It is. It's a ram.
Huh.
Did you know that?
Well, my assumption here is in Othello, there is a kind of a naughty line that Iago says. He compares Othello and Desdemona making the beast with two backs to like a ram tupping a white ewe. So I thought maybe tup could be an extension to a sheep.
That is brilliant work, Jess. Okay, I'm very, very impressed because it is. It's dialect. It's Central English dialect for a ram. And Derbyshire is actually famous for its rams. Our football team is called the Rams.
And they're literally horny too, so.
They are. Mm-hmm. They are horny. Very good. The attestation that I found was, in Derbyshire, there is no commoner saying to express anger shown by anyone than to say that he or she is as mad as a tup. And then another one, the last one I'm going to give you, I'm going to stop, is as mad as a wet hen.
Yeah, I mean, I reckon that would be pretty darn mad. Hens are vicious, little dinosaurs.
Yeah, if they were as big as cows, they would be the deadliest.
They would not be backyard pets. Speaking of farm animals, The most unsatisfying one I tried to research was to get someone's goat. I couldn't find a definitive answer. Like, there are theories, like the most popular theory that you will see repeated the most is from horse racing, because apparently goats have been historically and still sometimes are kept today in the stalls of high-strung horses, either to like calm them. They can also be like kept in pastures to ward off unwanted creatures because they're more aggressive and they might chase away a coyote or something along those lines. But apparently, specifically in with race horses, they would help keep them calm. You know, on the night before the big race, a rival trainer might sneak in and steal the goat, which would upset the horse and wreck its performance. But yeah. Like in the words of etymologist Michael Quinion, one would have to have a substantial ability to suspend one's disbelief to accept this theory as at face value because of how kind of fanciful it is.
It's not the silliest theory that we've heard for any idiom, though, and I'm willing to cite it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with that sure. theory. A couple other Why theories not? Just aren't quite as fun, is that like goats are kind of temperamental assholes. And another one is like, it does have an earlier French variation, prendre la chèvre, to take the goat means to make someone angry, maybe by virtue of stealing their goats. Another theory says it relates to scapegoats, but doesn't really explain why. It might just be literally stealing someone's goat.
Goats were more important to our culture, to Western European culture, than they are now in the past. They just were.
More people could afford to keep goats than cows. Like, wealth was measured in cows in many societies because it's expensive to have the land to keep a cow, but a lot of people can have goats.
Yeah, and we've talked specifically about the fact that the word butcher means goat preparer, basically.
And that peculiar referred originally to property in cattle. So, we've been there.
Yeah, we have. Can I bring in another animal while we're on animals?
Yeah, I've got a few more too.
Do you have the phrase white elephant in the States?
Yeah, for like a gift, sort of a prank gift party.
Oh, is that what you, really?
Yeah, okay. But like also it can be, there are a couple other senses of white elephant. Sometimes it's just like a blind gift giving thing and none of them have to be pranks.
That meaning I've never heard, but makes perfect sense with the origin of the phrase. When I've heard white elephant, we generally use it in Britain anyway, to refer to a large project, something that someone has created, almost a folly that was very expensive, but has very little usage and is in fact some sort of drain, right? We call it a white elephant. Like, there was fears when we built the Millennium Dome that it would ultimately end up being a white elephant once we'd finished using it.
We have a whole lot of sports complexes here that could be described in exactly that way.
But both what you've said about, you know, useless gifts and what I've said fit perfectly with the idea of the white elephant, which comes from ancient Siam, so Thailand, modern day Thailand, where albino elephants, believe it or not, were particularly prized as rare and indeed seen as sacred. And there was one Siamese king, a particularly spiteful one, it would appear, who, when a courtier or noble had fallen out of favor with him, he would gift them one of these white elephants. It might seem like a lavish gift, but what it actually is an enormous burden, because you can't put a white elephant to work because it's sacred. All you can do is spend huge amounts of money on keeping it alive, because if you don't, you're doing something wholly unholy. So the white elephant is the gift you really don't want, which fits so well with that sense that you mentioned that I've genuinely never heard.
White elephants are actually, or albino elephants are actually pink, aren't they?
Is that so?
They're very pretty.
Pink elephants came up in a conversation I was having the other day.
Pink elephants on parade.
Yeah, it was about the late stages of alcoholism, I suppose, where you start to hallucinate. You stop getting REM sleep and you stop getting the sleep that is giving you the dreams that you would normally have. And so you start to hallucinate during the day. And that's when the pink elephants start to appear. That bit in Dumbo scared the heck out of me, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to say, does that predate, I would assume, that story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the pink elephant's on parade. The whole point is Dumbo's drunk, right? And he's seen the pink elephants. There's also a very famous Belgian brewery called Delirium, and their logo is this pink elephant.
Say if you get to the stage of alcoholism where you're seeing pink elephants, you might try going cold turkey to stop, right?
Right, yeah. So tell me what this is all about. Because I imagine you're sort of if you're going cold turkey, you're maybe getting goose pimples or something like that. But
that is literally exactly it. It is. There are a number of other like theories about them, but it is probably most likely that you look like a plucked turkey because you are shaky and pale and clammy and you have goosebumps all over you.
So it does originate in the idea of, you know, coming off drugs without any sort of ramp, does it?
Yeah. Basically, you stop using your drugs and then you get all shaky and weird. But apparently, John Lennon and Yoko Ono helped popularize it in common discourse, though it does dramatically predate that. But apparently their song Cold Turkey with the Plastic Ono Band helped make it a little more popular across various countries and whatnot.
Oh, there you go.
But there are a couple of like weird other theories that are almost certainly untrue.
But these are the more fun ones, right? So bring it on.
There's a 1920s phrase, taking cold turkey, as slang for pleading guilty. And it might be related to the expression talking turkey, which means to speak bluntly or without euphemism. Apparently back as early as the 1860s, it was said to come from a tale of an attempt to swindle a Native American person into dividing up a turkey and a goose instead of just keeping their turkey, the goose being the less appealing bird. And apparently they didn't fall for it. So they might say, like the Kentucky hunter says, you may take the goose and I'll take the turkey, or I'll take the turkey and you take the goose, anything to satisfy. The Native American person says, never talk turkey to me.
Right.
So recurring joke, I guess. I only sort of get it.
You know, funny enough that when I was looking for things to discuss, I did come across another one that it's all about sort of mistreatment of Native Americans, or at least, you know, the reason it takes off is through the mischaracterizations or the unfair characterization of Native Americans. One of them is Big White Chief or Great White Chief, which is a deliberately sort of ungrammatical or clunky sounding in sort of way of mimicking the speech of Native Americans. The other one, though, that was surprising to me as a Brit, because I hadn't even considered that this might come from America rather than Asia, is the phrase Indian summer, which just refers to the idea that the Indians, the Native Americans, are living in parts of America, North America, where in the autumn it's just a bit warmer. There are a couple of other sort of elucidations on the explanation that I just gave from times past, like from the 1800s. There's a couple. One of them is 1812. It says, this charming season is called the Indian summer, a name which is derived from the natives who believe it is caused by a wind which comes immediately from the court of their great and benevolent god, Cowtantawit, or the southwestern god. So you can see that they're sort of trying to call upon native myth or folklore to explain it away there.
Which is wildly misappropriated across idiom and culture.
Should set off alarm bells when you hear it. Another explanation from 1824 as well, from Notes on Settlement in Virginia and Pennsylvania, was this was an Indian summer because it afforded the Indians another opportunity of visiting the settlements with their destructive warfare. So they're saying it's called an Indian summer because it gives Indians another chance to attack. So completely different explanations, both of which are having a dig at the Indians.
While we're on the topic of hot summers, the phrase dog days of summer refers to the rising of the star Sirius, also known as the dog star in the constellation Canis Major.
Oh, right. So the dog days are when you can see Canis Major.
Mm-hmm. But it's also known for its extreme heat. And then like folk etymology or folklore associates it with like dogs being susceptible to the heat and succumbing to it as well. But it's really more to do with the star. Do you know what it means to say that you can't hold a candle to something or someone?
So figuratively, it means that you don't compare to them. Is that right?
That is correct. You're not as good. You don't even come close. You're nowhere near as skilled as them, or something, you know, isn't nearly as good as something else. This one has a really satisfying explanation, and it appears to be true. Apprentices and assistants would literally hold a candle over the master creator artisans work so that they could see what they were doing. If you are so incompetent that you can't even hold a candle in their presence, you weren't even good enough to be the helper, the understudy, or the light source.
Oh, so you're not even worthy of holding a candle to their work.
Exactly that. And it dates back to like the mid 16th century. So it does appear to be that does appear to be the genuine explanation for it.
Another one that I wanted to mention was to pull out all of the stops.
Ah, musical one, yes?
It's a musical one, yeah, which I didn't know. Because I think when I think of stops, I'm thinking maybe stoppers in wine. What am I thinking about? But it's not. It's stoppers in a pipe organ. Because stoppers are the things that you use to control, I suppose, the airflow and ultimately the volume of a pipe organ. So if you pull out all of the stops, the pipe organ can play at its ultimate fortitude, its ultimate volume, its ultimate loudness, and uninhibited, which I really like. And actually, other terms with stop in them are sort of bringing out a similar idea, which is, a stop gap, for example, is something that, that fills a gap. It's like a stop is a stopper, right? But I haven't really heard of stop used as a noun.
I feel like being able to like dramatically play a pipe organ is one of the ultimate flexes in the world, because like you're basically commanding a room-sized instrument and you look super dramatic and awesome and the sound just fills up the space.
Yeah. And it's been used figuratively for a long time, for a couple of hundred years anyway. Like there's a 19th century reference that actually comes before the phrase to pull out all the stops, but shows you that the idea of the pipe organ and releasing it from its inhibitions is starting to sort of percolate in people's minds as something that's going to eventually come out as a fully fledged idiom. And it's a quote that says, a few more stops in that somewhat narrow toned organ, the modern Englishman should be pulled out.
I had the privilege of touring the back of a massive pipe organ that's located in the Skirmerhorn Symphony Hall in Nashville. A few years ago, there was a flood there and it flooded the Skirmerhorn and they had to lift up the location of the organ. So walking around like the backstage area where they like redid it and everything is so, so neat to see.
Did you see the stops? Can you remember what they looked like?
They're on the front of the organ. You like pop them out. I don't know enough to be 100% sure that that's correct, but I think it is. You pull them out on the front and then it lets the air go up in. One that I also don't know anything about, but is kind of fun to talk about is the acid test. Do you know this one?
Well, no. I mean, I guess I just assumed it was a sort of litmus test and they were kind of just the same idea, you know?
It is. It relates to gold originally. It's a noble metal. It doesn't dissolve in most acids and it's a good candidate for field testing. So if you want to check that a shiny yellow lump is real gold, you'd rub it on a black touchstone, apply nitric acid and then see what happens. And if the mark goes away, it's a fake. And if it stays, it might be the real thing. And then you can do other tests to see if it's gold. And this dates back to like the 1700s or something and then really took off as an idiom during the California gold rush.
I really like that. But both that and the pull out all the stops now have created new images in my head that I will attach to those idioms when I hear them.
Let's shift into some apparel related idioms. And speaking of which, we discovered when we signed on that we were totally, well, semi-serendipitously because we both run the shop, but we found we were wearing the same shirt, which we sell in our shops, our astronaut etymology shirts designed by my sister, Melissa Ferris, who did the illustration for them. Those, I think, are our best seller in the shop, by the way.
Ah.
And they come in a lot of different variations. I just added some premium sweatshirts that now are available there. So check those out if you also want your Star Sailor shirt.
It's a beaut. And there are a variety of other wordy, nerdy designs on there for you as well. You can end up with an entire wardrobe full of these things like I've got now. I basically only wear merchandise now.
Always be marketing, as they say.
Indeed, indeed. Always be, well, go on, which idiom are we going to use? Yeah.
Well, you might say that we use things like this to metaphorically pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, right? But that term was originally ironic and not meant to reflect the way we use it today. It originated shortly before the turn of the 20th century, and one of the first recorded instances of the concept is in physics school books, like the 1888 Popular Physics by Joel Dorman Steele, that contained the example question, why can a man not lift himself up by pulling on his bootstraps? Mm. So when it became a colloquial phrase originally referring to like socioeconomic advancement, it was meant to suggest that that's an impossible accomplishment. You cannot lift yourself by your bootstraps physically. It is impossible. Eventually, however, the phrase's commonly accepted meaning evolved. And now when we tell someone to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, it's implying that's something that could be, it's difficult, but it's possible. We have this in like a variety of other contexts, bootstrapping or using something to lift something else up, something usually smaller to lift up something bigger is in, it's used in entrepreneurship, it's used in like computing, bootstrapping, software, web development, electronics, law even, and statistics specifically, the method for basically assigning measures of accuracy to sample estimates using smaller data points to justify larger ones.
Oh, that's a new one to me, bootstrapping.
Yeah, it's called the bootstrap method. The way it was explained to me, you start out by showing that a number in a set satisfies a weaker property than the property you want to prove is true for all numbers. And if you can show that the number satisfies the weaker property, you can imply that the number must also satisfy the stronger property, and it kind of proves the whole set.
Yep, I'm going to nod like I understood that, Jess.
Because boots with bootstraps, which are they're the things on the back of your boot that help you pull the boot on. They were not common on boots or fashionable or regularly used on boots until like the 1870s. So the character Bootstrap Bill in Pirates of the Caribbean, which is set in the late 1700s, is an anachronism.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, at that point, bootstraps, if you used that phrase, you were probably referring to like your laces or something.
Ah, okay.
One more apparel-related one is the term having your work cut out for you. This is from tailoring. In the 16th and 17th centuries, your assistants might, if you were a master tailor, your assistants would cut out all the pieces of fabric for a suit or a garment, but that meant you still had a bunch of work to do, like assembling and shaping and fitting and stitching. So that's when the real work begins.
Right. So you got your work cut out for you means that someone has done the preliminary thing, but now you've really got to get to work on the rest of it.
Now you got to do all the stuff.
Gotcha. That's great. And the word tailor just means to cut, right? Mm-hmm. So we might have got there if we tried to take the etymological route.
My mom is a tailor, as a matter of fact. Have you seen the movie The Notebook?
No, I haven't seen it, but I've had it recommended to me, yes.
There's a blue dress that Rachel McAdams is wearing on all the posters, and it's like famous for being a cute dress that a lot of people recognize from a movie. She made that for that movie.
So as well as your sister designing this fabulous t-shirt, the sartorial pedigree in your household is there for all to see on the silver screen.
It missed me though, somehow.
No, you designed some very nice things for our shop as well. People should go and check those out.
I do my best.
Yeah, and if you buy all of our merch, you can be dressed up to the nines.
Ah, there's another one.
Yeah, there is another one. So we don't know exactly where this one comes from, but there's quite a nice, satisfying explanation, and that it refers to the 99th Wiltshire Regiment, so a military regiment in England that was known for being particularly well-dressed. So the nines are the 99 in the name of the regiment, which I like. But I did have a look at some other nine-based idioms, because nine, of all the numbers, but you know, it sort of gets more than its fair share of idioms.
It's got like a cube and it does stuff. I don't know.
Yes, it's nice,
easily divisible and has threes and all kinds of things involved.
It just sounds like a big number without going for 10. And actually, that is where the phrase on cloud nine comes from. There's an old grading system for clouds that went from 0 to 10, and nine was obviously very high, but not the highest. The original phrase was on cloud 7, but cloud nine is what caught on. And you know, you're saying cloud 10 would be a bit, you know, that's excessive, but cloud 9 is still very, very high.
7 is like theologically significant, right?
Is it?
I'm going to go with yes. I didn't come with any information to back up that claim. But so is 9, right? Because 3s are significant.
Yeah.
Christianity.
A trinity of trinities is nine. Right. And then there's the whole nine yards, which is the one that I really wanted to get to, because this is the one that's got the most possible explanations. One of them is more likely than the others, but I'll run through some of the alternatives to what is probably the source of the phrase. But it's been explained away by, for example, the idea that World War II fighter planes had 27 feet of ammunition, which is 9 yards. So if you fired them all off, you went the whole 9 yards, or the full 9 yards, meaning you'd gone as far as you could. Another theory is that it refers to the full length of a kilt. So having the, you know, a kilt isn't just a skirt, right? It goes around, it goes up and it goes over. It's this whole garment. The problem with that one is a kilt is 8 yards long, generally. I think they can be 5 yards or 8 yards, not nine. So that's why that one doesn't quite work. Another theory is that it refers to the amount that a concrete truck would dispense, which is clearly the dullest. The phrase, it seems with all likelihood, comes from an anecdote from the United States told in the sort of North Carolina, Kentucky area. You'll have to help me out if that is a stupid geographical reference or whatever.
No, that's reasonable.
Okay, good. And it's from an anecdote that's known as the judge's big shirt. I don't know if you've ever heard of this.
So the basically, judge's big shirt.
Yeah. So again, the 19th century anecdote. A judge arrives in Raleigh. I think you pronounce it Raleigh or Raleigh, North Carolina, Carolina, for a business trip. And he realizes that he doesn't have a shirt for a function that he has to go to the next day. So he asks a lawyer friend to source him one. And this lawyer friend of his wants to teach him a lesson for having forgotten his shirt. So he orders a massive, massive shirt for the guy, because it's not common to order a shirt without going to the tailor, right? So he's also trying to punish him for being having the audacity to ask him to just somehow pluck a shirt out of the air. So he takes delivery of this shirt, gives it to the judge. The judge says, "Oh, this is rather nice. I love the. Hasn't it been nicely put together?" But then he opens it out, and he realizes that it is 5 yards long and 4 yards broad. And so the lawyer friend, pretending that he hasn't ordered this massive shirt himself, says, "What a silly, stupid woman," of the seamstress. "I told her to get just enough to make 3 shirts. Instead of making 3, she has put the whole 9 yards into 1 shirt.
And this is the most likely origin?
Sounds rubbish, doesn't it?
It does.
The phrase has currency in that part of the United States before anywhere else. And this is a story people are telling there. And so, yeah, it's the most likely source.
I love it. That's so interesting. Another one that sounds very American to me is dollars to donuts. You know, I'd bet dollars to donuts I'm right about this origin.
What would we say? We'd say pounds to pies in England.
Would you?
We don't.
I was like, no.
That would be our version.
I was so excited.
We're gonna
start saying it now.
I am. Pounds to pies. Where would you use dollars to donuts? What's the context for that one?
I'd bet dollars to donuts that this is the correct origin of this word. There are older expressions. This one came up in the 1920s, but there was also dollars to buttons and dollars to dumplings, and all of them are playing the same trick, putting dollars, the amount of a symbol of like serious cash, up against something trivial. The other thing about like dumplings are cheap and buttons are forgettable and cheap as well, but donuts are cheap and doughy, and potentially because they are shaped like a zero. That is the element there. Like, they're cheap to make. The other thing that helps that theory, whether it's true or not, is that it aligns time-wise with the invention of the first automatic donut machine in 1920, which cemented the O shape of the donut as sort of your standard donut. When you imagine a donut, you usually start mentally with the O donut rather than the cream-filled donut or whatever else. And that would also have made donuts cheaper to purchase.
But it does get used as a word for zero donut, like bagel does, in particularly in sport, and donut does as well for, you know, big fat O.
The various other versions were bet a dollar to a donut, wager a dollar to a donut, or just generally dollars to donuts. It's the same idea similarly as like betting your bottom dollar like Annie does on Broadway.
You guys are so money orientated.
Oh, very much so.
Unlike we British, who are just mainly tea orientated.
Now that we have cut to the chase of these idiom origins, which, by the way, is it's a relatively simple explanation. It means if you are making a movie and you feel like your audiences are getting might get bored with your plot that you've set up, you cut to the chase scene. Comes from early Hollywood.
Oh, that's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
That's
when
really
in doubt,
good.
Cut to the chase scene.
Very good. I've really enjoyed this one, Jess. Yeah. Always do enjoy the idiom episodes, and we're going to make more of these, I think, because there are so many idioms out there, so many interesting explanations out there, so many spurious ones as well. But picking them apart is great fun.
Yeah, we'll do this again. So drop your requests in the comments if you're watching on YouTube. You can find us both on Blue Sky and at a couple other places. So feel free to tag me in, and I'd be so happy to jot those down for our next version of Idioms Unraveled.
Sounds good. Catch you next time.